This is The Takeaway for August 31st, 2015.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. In this hour, the president heads north. The fragile Arctic gets political as northern powers try to grab a piece of its energy resources, plus the politics of coal further south. In the lower 48, taxpayers miss out on billions in payments from coal pulled from federal land. And some reflections of our own time on this planet as we remember the life and death of neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks. Some of you are sharing what you learned about life from him.
Hi, my name is Debbie Hemingway. I live in Winters, California. I find that the less that I think about myself and the more kindness that I can show to others, the more worthwhile I then believe my own life to be.
And from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Dr. Sacks so richly nurtured a sense of mystery and how we know more and more about how we know less and less. You can join the conversation, too. Tell us what makes your life worthwhile. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. But we begin today with President Obama, who heads to Alaska and becomes the first American president to visit the Arctic. In Alaska, the president is addressing a meeting of Arctic nation foreign ministers from Russia and Norway, Canada, the United States and others, as well as a roundtable of Alaskan natives. It's a trip designed to show, literally show, visually, the parts of the country where climate change isn't a theory, but a fact that's going on right now. Meanwhile, in a kind of goodwill gesture toward the Native community, the president announced on Sunday that Mount McKinley, the highest mountain peak in North America that looms at just over 20,000 feet and was named for President William McKinley, will be formally renamed Denali, restoring an Alaskan Native name and a name that most locals use anyway. But as rising temperatures, extensive wildfires, and melting sea ice are reshaping the shoreline at a very quick pace, many Alaskan natives are stepping up to warn of overdevelopment and exploitation of the resources of the region. Here's Yvonne Peter, an Alaska Native leader, speaking to the BBC over the weekend.
I think that it really is important for us to slow things down. And what that looks like is in the initial time saying, okay, let's protect this area for a 10, 15-year period as we do the science, as we have the conversations, rather than letting it be this kind of frontier mentality where all the countries try to rush in to do as much development and first. I think we can't allow an unwieldy level of competition or distrust between nations or multinational corporations to guide how we move into the Arctic.
So how we move into the Arctic, whether we drill and how we drill for oil, is one of the biggest questions facing countries like the United States and Canada. As Russia continues to step up claims for larger portions of the Arctic Ocean and receding ice cover exposes previously frozen land in Greenland, Siberia, Norway, and other countries. For more on the geopolitical strategy of the U.S. and Arctic countries in the region, we spoke with Katarzyna Zisk. She's associate professor at the Norwegian Defense University College in Oslo. She's also a member of the Arctic Security Initiative at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. She's joined by Edward Struzik, a Canadian journalist. He's also author of Future Arctic, Field Notes from a World on the Edge. And he says the president is up against a dilemma and a rising set of challenges in the region.
It's astonishing to see that the Arctic that we once knew in Alaska and northern Canada is quickly disappearing and a new Arctic is unfolding. And it's all pretty much the result of climate change.
But Alaska is also the very epitome of the dilemma, isn't it? Because climate change is real, is happening. The president will stand in front of glaciers that have disappeared. He will go to villages that are flooding because of sea level rise. At the same time, Alaska has enormous economic reliance on fossil fuels and enormous political pressure on the White House to expand drilling, which he has done. And therein lies the conflict. The very people who are confronting climate change right now need and want drilling.
Well, it's true, but I think the lessons of the past suggest that we need to learn from them. Alaska, you know, was graced by the Prudhoe Bay oil field that lasted almost forever, and now it's starting to deplete, and they're looking for new ways of finding energy, and it's becoming very expensive and very dangerous. And I liken it to what's happened here in Alberta with the oil sands. The Alberta economy relied on the oil sands for so long and so much that now that oil prices have collapsed, the economy has just collapsed along with it.
Katarzyna Zisk, at the same time, President Obama, while making a visual display out of climate change, has recently signed off on expanded drilling for Royal Dutch Shell in northern Alaska. And this is part of a much bigger picture, because you've been writing about Russia and its advances on its continental shelf. The geopolitics of the Arctic is changing fast, and the gold rush is on here.
That's true. We have seen an increasing interest basically from all Arctic countries, and not only the Arctic countries around the Arctic Ocean, the United States, Canada, Norway, Denmark, but also other stakeholders like for instance, the Asian countries, China, South Korea, India. So there has been an increased interest in the region because of the energy resources, but also because of the climate change. And also the Russian policies, especially since 2007, have been more assertive, which also turned the attention of the international community, and especially the Arctic countries, toward the region.
I remember seeing a picture in 2007 of a Russian flag, a metal Russian flag, on the bottom of the seabed under the North Pole. The Russians planted it there to show the world, this is ours. Has the United States been slow to the land grab or the melting ice grab that's going on in the Arctic?
Well, in general, the Obama administration has devoted steadily more attention to the region. There is no doubt about that. There is a number of documents like Arctic Regional Policy, National Strategy for the Region, that has been adopted recently. Several documents underline the importance of the Arctic region. But at the same time, the budgetary action is not there. There is simply no significant increase in money that would follow up the increased attention, at least rhetorically, for the Arctic region. Admiral Paul Sukhumvit, the Coast Guard commander, even said that actually the U.S. is not even in the game, which is kind of a significant statement, I think.
Yeah, it is significant. Edward Struzik, it's interesting what Katarzyna is saying, because if the Russians want to increase drilling in the Arctic, if the Russians think more access to warm water ports will be available where ice once froze the ocean, surely Alaskans are going to want part of that economic activity and part of that trade. And there's a deeper dilemma even there.
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question, is that do you invest billions, possibly trillions of dollars in developing the infrastructure you need to accommodate this kind of very expensive, very risky development? I say, you know, let's put that out for debate before we start drilling in these waters, because we have no ports in northern Alaska or anywhere in Arctic Canada to facilitate this kind of activity. So if there was an oil spill, how would you deal with it? I mean, in multi-year ice or even seasonal ice, it would be almost impossible to get up there and handle an oil spill or a natural gas well blowout on par with what happened in the Gulf of Mexico.
Katarzyna, is Vladimir Putin thinking of the kinds of concerns that Edward is discussing right now? Is he thinking, how do you drill safely? How do you invest billions in a warm water port and protect against a spill? Or is it basically a grab that's on and he's gone to the UN to stake his claim and put pressure on everybody else?
Definitely. There has been an increased awareness that this kind of accidents in the Arctic would be a disaster on a global scale. And Russia has been steadily more interested in devoting more attention to this kind of issues, developing search and rescue capability, for instance, along the Arctic coast. They are aware of that and they have been investing somewhat. However, this is still insufficient level. Most experts agree that we still do not have the necessary search and rescue, crisis management, human disaster capabilities that are necessary to act in case of, for instance, oil spill or other kinds of disaster. And this is extremely difficult region to operate in, and we are still not sufficiently prepared. Russia is not prepared either.
Edward Struzik, I know you're Canadian, but play American pundit for a second if you want to. The president is trying to build policies here at home for his climate change initiatives, carbon reduction, more efficient cars, coal plants, the Environmental Protection Agency. A lot of stuff's been going on domestically. He's also trying to build momentum going into the Paris conference in December, the global climate change conference. Does he risk some of that momentum if his message is mixed? If he stands in front of villages and towns where climate change is real, but of course the second line of everyone's report is that he just signed off on big new drilling deals along the Arctic coast.
Yeah, I think he has to make a clear choice here. And quite honestly, I think it's a fairly easy choice to make because of everything that we've talked about. The North American Arctic is just not ready for that kind of development that's taking or that is about to take place. And I think that he can simply say is that the time is just not right.
Katarzyna Zisk, what's that new vision look like to you? Is it confrontation and competition for resources and for oil, or is it mutual opportunity? Everybody's got lots of money to make if they do it right, and so all of a sudden Vladimir Putin has a reason to cooperate with the United States and Canada.
The short answer would be both. We still do not have any energy bonanza like many expected or mad dash for natural resources and territories in the Arctic. But on the other hand, we have certainly seen an increased interest and increased, let's say, sense of insecurity, not least in Russia. And Russia has been reacting to this increased international interest in the Arctic by strengthening its presence, also military presence, which, you know, in turn also strengthen the sense of insecurity in the other countries, especially that Russia has become so much more belligerent and assertive in security and defense and foreign policies. And we have also seen that the Arctic is also very vulnerable to spillover effects from other crises in the world, like the Ukrainian crisis, which has affected security situation in the Arctic as well. There is less contact between Russia and the other countries. There is more tension. The military activities has increased. So as of today, I wouldn't say that there is a big danger for conflict in the Arctic or over the Arctic territories. But the Arctic is, again, remains very vulnerable to spillover effects, and they affect the regional stability negatively.
Changing ecology, changing climate, and rapidly changing geopolitics between the countries around the Arctic. Edward Struzik, Canadian journalist and author of Future Arctic Field Notes from A World on Edge. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Katarzyna Zisk, associate professor at the Norwegian Defense University in Oslo. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, this is Mark Mannheimer, and I'm calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. The most important thing I learned from Oliver Sacks was to be in the moment, always, and to be aware of how my actions influence and affect others. As a professor, I try to manifest that and always be there for my students, be available to them and help them in any way I can. Living my life this way has definitely made it worthwhile and fulfilling. I will miss his voice.
We remember neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks this hour, and we're asking you, what makes your life good and worthwhile? From Walnut Creek, California, maintaining a sense of awe, finding the humor in my own knuckleheaded flaws, and doing my darndest to wake up before I leave this earthly body. R.I.P. Oliver Sacks, you enriched so many of our lives. From Portland, Oregon, Oliver Sacks was a hero. His book, Music Ophelia, was absolutely groundbreaking. Music is the ultimate healing force that knows no borders. It keeps me sane. Sacks's devotion to the humanity of his scientific study was maybe his greatest gift, his ability to tap into what does keep us sane. He could convey the unfathomable complexity of the human brain in ways that everyone could understand. And he imparted his own experiences on hallucinations, a subject he wrote widely about. Dr. Sacks once wrote that about 20 minutes after taking LSD, he remembered seeing the color indigo. He said it was luminous, numinous. It filled me with rapture. Oliver Sacks first gained notoriety in the early 1970s with his book Awakenings, which followed a group of patients suffering from encephalitis, or inflammation of the brain, otherwise known as sleeping sickness. His findings in Awakening were so intriguing that it was eventually adapted into a feature film starring Robin Williams and Robert De Niro. And Sacks's love for music also led him down a long road of discovery of the relationship between music and the mind. He devoted an entire book to the subject, Musicophilia, in 2007. You heard our listener mention that earlier. Much of that work was done with our next guest. Connie Tomaino is executive director and co-founder of the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function. Oliver Sacks helped her establish that institute, and they were close friends for more than 30 years. She says Sacks believed in her research when no one else did.
You know, Oliver, when I first met him, was a very shy, introverted person who didn't reveal much about himself. I mean, he did his work and he had his friends and was social in that way, but really kept to himself. And his sharing, I think, became part of his being accepted and having so many people validate who he was. and his feeling part of the community of the world of people interested in others and in the well-being of others. And I think his sensitivity to being loved by so many people allowed him to open up and to share. I mean, he's just started talking about his drug use not too long ago. I mean, in some of his books, he hinted at it, and then it wasn't until later on that he actually talked about it to some degree. And then, of course, on the move, he goes into much more detail, personal detail.
And you think that he came to feel that acceptance on a very real level, not just fame, which can be very distant, but real?
Yeah, I don't know if Oliver ever felt famous. You know, he was so humble in that sense. I think he felt nurtured and appreciated by people, and he had volumes of emails that he would get every day, but he was very humble. I think everybody would agree who met him face-to-face that this was a very warm, caring person who indeed cared. And when he wrote, it wasn't that he was writing to become famous. Some people do that. They just keep publishing things just to get their name out there. I think he was really writing because he wanted to share this information with others and to let them know how wonderful and incredible these lives are.
Was it important to him specifically to humanize the brain, to humanize all of these conditions, the man who mistook his wife for a hat, all the rest of them, over at Pfizer or Janssen Pharmaceuticals, where they deal with selective serotonin reuptake and the neuron and the profit that comes from these and sort of the reductionist theories of mental illness? Was it important to him to humanize these things?
Oh, absolutely. I think he only saw things in the sense of human awareness and function. In fact, he had a long correspondence with A.R. Luria, the Russian, the father of neuropsychology. And Luria told him, keep writing these case studies that, you know, really look at the phenomenon of what this person is experiencing, because as you describe their behaviors, responses, limitations, whatever that is, we get to learn about the neurology of that condition. And if you limit things so specifically, you lose the whole picture of what exactly this person is going through, what the phenomenon of their brain function is. Because if you isolate it so, you know, minutely, there's no way you can really understand the phenomena of the complexity of that system.
And it seems to me we can't go back now, and thankfully so. I mean, we've been exposed now to a new vision of neuroscience and neurology that's a lot more inclusive of the whole brain, the whole person, the whole system.
That's really true. And what I'm hearing more and more are the general public, as well as physicians and scientists, are shying away from looking at medication as the end all for treatment, or to look at a diagnosis as the end all of a prognosis of an individual, because human function is so complex and that the systems in the brain are so complex and there's so much redundancy, that to limit one with a medication may actually undo a very important function that can aid to that person's recovery, survival, development.
Connie Tomeno, what do you think you'll miss most about your friend? Oh. What do you think?
Too many things. His friendship, his wit, his knowledge, his sharing and compassion about the work and his love of life.
And a life well lived. I mean, it's not a cliche in this case.
Oh,
no,
absolutely.
Doubt about it. 82 years and
yeah.
A life that benefited just millions of people.
Absolutely. When I met him in 1980, he was 45, 46, and he didn't think he'd make it to his 50th birthday. And then he had this wonderful party. And from there, I think he celebrated every year robustly.
Connie Tomeno is executive director and co-founder of the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function, a dear friend also of Oliver Sacks, her co-founder and close friend for more than 30 years. Connie, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Todd.
You have to build a movement so strong in this country that if one black man is touched, every black man will rise up and let this country know they're not going to tolerate it.
So it's not fun having all these people in jail, but these are freedom fighters. They're the vanguard.
Solution has come. Oh, it's time to pick up the gun.
And if you're not prepared for that, then you don't belong with the Black Panther Party.
49 years ago, as black Americans protested for equal rights and faced an ongoing onslaught of violence from their white neighbors, police, and elected officials, a new movement arose out of that, and it was not based on Martin Luther King's philosophy of nonviolent resistance. Rather, at least in the beginning, it was about arming black citizens to protect themselves and to challenge police brutality. It was 1966, it was October, and the founders of the movement called themselves the Black Panther Party.
We use the Black Panther as our symbol because the Panther doesn't strike anyone, but when he's assailed upon, that he'll back up first. But if the aggressor continues, then he'll strike out.
That's the voice of Huey Newton, the founder of the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers' Vanguard of the Revolution is the first feature-length documentary to explore the history and the lasting cultural impact of the Black Panther Party. It opens in selected theaters this week. It's directed by award-winning filmmaker Stanley Nelson, who joins me in the studio now. And we're also joined by former Black Panther Michael D. McCarty, who's in Los Angeles. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Ditto. Thank you. Greetings.
Very good to have both of you. Stanley Nelson, the Black Panther Party started not as a national movement. There were national movements going on at the time. This started as a local response in Oakland to Oakland police by Oakland people.
Right. You got it perfectly right. The Panther started in Oakland because of the police brutality there. The police in Oakland were notorious. And Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, maybe four or five others got together and said, you know, we got to do something about it. There was a strange law at that time in California that said you could carry a gun as long as it was in the open, a loaded weapon in the open. And so what they did was followed the police, basically just rode around behind the police. When the police would stop somebody, they would jump out behind the police and try to make sure that no brutality occurred. But they also had loaded weapons.
So they would follow the police around, police encounters. This helped protect black people who were being arrested or searched, certainly, but there was also a show of force. There was also a counter-intimidation factor, I think.
Yeah, as a former policeman that we interview in the film says, it was pretty intimidating to jump out and do a traffic stop, let's say, and right behind you, six or seven armed black men jump out with rifles and kind of stand there observing what you do.
Michael McCarty, what do you remember of the time? Were you in Oakland?
No, I'm from Chicago, but I remember that. Because that was the thing that got my attention. They did what just about every black person wanted to do in terms of confronting the racism and the brutality and saying, all right, enough of this. We're not going to march. We're not going to pray. If you mess with us, we're going to mess with you back. And that was just a galvanizing concept.
Michael D. McCarty, one of the interesting points in the film is the contrast with the Southern Civil Rights Movement. That was a movement of the South. That was a religious movement. The Panthers weren't. The Panthers were a Northern movement and an urban movement. Does that ring true with you? And can you sort of explain why that was important?
Well, what you had is many of the members of the party, Fred Hampton and myself were members of the NAACP. Many of us had come out of the civil rights movement, had been involved with the civil rights movement. We had participated in marches and demonstrations or seen our friends and loved ones getting beaten. And basically, there was a growing movement within the NAACP, a youth wing that wanted to do something else. So when the Black Panther Party came along, there was the opportunity to do that something else, to take it to a different level, to take a different approach, more in line with Malcolm X's idea. Say, I'll be nonviolent with you as long as you're nonviolent with me. But if you grab a gun, I'm going to grab a gun too.
Stanley Nelson, one of the jumping off points of your film is the difficulty the Panthers had when their movement caught on and expanded across the country. And you have Panthers from the early days saying it got so big so fast. We got all comers. We got people from every corner. We didn't know who they were and they were armed.
Well, in the film, what we're kind of leading to is the fact that the Panthers were riddled with informers. J. Edgar Hoover sent out an edict that said the Black Panthers were the greatest internal threat to the security of America. Basically, he said to his agents, do whatever you can, just make sure whatever you do doesn't come back onto the FBI. So, you know, they would do dirty tricks. They would pit husband against wife, Panther against Panther, Panthers against other groups, anything that they could possibly think of to try to destroy the Panthers.
Stanley Nelson, your thinking, having made this film during yet another episode of confrontation of police brutality in this country, how much things have changed or haven't, how you're thinking about that context as your film comes out.
I think one of the things that's so startling about the film is when we talk about the Panthers' 10-point program. You know, we want to end police brutality. We want decent employment for black people. We want decent schools. We want decent housing. You know, all of those things are things that are still with us and that we're still fighting for today.
Now, you've gone through a history of the Black Panthers and what they stood for, but you're also a filmmaker, obviously, someone who understands the importance of the image and of the video image. And the difference today, of course, is the image. iPhone images, body cameras. Back in 1966, such a thing didn't exist. A lot of this was hidden from public view. It's not hidden anymore.
Right. One of the things that I've heard somebody say is that right now in America, we're at a moment where white folks are saying, wait a minute, you know, why didn't you tell us? You know, now we're seeing it. Why didn't you tell us? And black people are saying, we have been telling you for 100 years that this has been going on. This is not something new. It's not like it went away with the Panthers and came back. Also, as we look today, you know, maybe it's the camera is the new gun. You know, the Panthers carried these guns to try to protect the citizenry from the police. I think that cameras are now, they're not protecting people because it hasn't worked, but it's making people see and making people talk about what's going on in this country in a way that they didn't a year ago. I think we're in a totally different moment now.
The film is Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. Stanley Nelson is the director. He's also the director of Freedom Riders and The Murder of Emmett Till. Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution opens in selected theaters this week. Stanley Nelson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also, Michael D. McCarty, former Black Panther from Chicago, now in Los Angeles. Mr. McCarty, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Before we go today, some more of your thoughts now on living a meaningful life in the wake of the death of Dr. Oliver Sacks. Michael in Hawaii tells us, friends, my animals, work, long-term sobriety, that has given me a wonderfully full spiritual life and a new, awesome relationship with my son. We had been estranged 5 years and are healing and have a loving, caring relationship today.
Hi, this is Linda Hohola, and I'm calling from Pittstown, New Jersey. What makes my life good and worthwhile is my advocacy and my child. My focus is justice and equal access. Now that marriage equality is law, I make my life worthwhile by working for tribal equality to make the world better in which my son lives.
Hi, this is Mia Kirsten from Austin, Texas. What makes my life worthwhile are friendships and connections to other human beings through art and music. When I see something someone has created, whether it's a film, a book, painting, songs, or even stand-up comedy, that I say, wow, someone else gets it. I'm not the only one alone in this.
That's all for today, but you can respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can leave your comments on our website at thetakeaway.org. And if you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news, and we'd love to take the ride with you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry all this week. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.